loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, we talk about the BBC Syria producer who wrote this week that the supposed chemical weapons attack in Douma was in fact fabricated. Next, Representative Ilhan Omar grilled Elliot Abrams yesterday about his involvement in genocide and other war crimes. Then we hear updates from our regular guest Ted Rall about his case against the LA Times for firing him due to anti-police department cartoons. And then, two new updates in the Russiagate saga. And finally, our regular Thursday segment, Veterans for Peace, is about the resolution the House passed against the war in Yemen. But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. After public pressure, Amazon today canceled the New York part of their second headquarters. Since Amazon announced its decision to put one of two new headquarters in New York in January of 2019, activists have organized huge protests and a No New Home for Amazon in NYC campaign. Residents feared that rents would become even more unaffordable and were outraged at the enormous tax breaks and other perks the corporation received from state and city politicians. Vice President Pence spoke today at the Warsaw Conference on the Middle East, saying, quote, "The time has come for our European partners to withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal and join with us," unquote. Since pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal last year, the Trump administration has been pressuring the European countries that are part of the deal to also back out on their commitments to sanctions relief. William Barr was confirmed in the Senate today to be the new U.S. Attorney General. The Senate voted mostly on party lines, 54 to 45. Barr will succeed Jeff Sessions, who left the role in 2018. He's expected to be sworn in today. Venezuelan Foreign Minister Jorge Arreaza told reporters today that a newly formed group of 50 countries will be taking action, quote, "to raise awareness around the dangers that our people currently face," unquote. These countries joined together at the United Nations today to show support for Venezuela in the face of a U.S.-backed coup attempt and threats of war. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Following an in-depth investigation by James Harkin published in The Intercept about the Douma chemical weapons attack, that's Syria, a BBC reporter has come out publicly to say that he can confirm the core claims of the article, which challenged the dominant narrative around that attack that served as a pretext for a U.S. strike on Syria, a missile strike. We're joined from Sheffield, England by Dr. Piers Robinson. Dr. Robinson is the chairman of the Politics, Society, and Political Journalism Department at the University of Sheffield and the author of Routledge Handbook of Media, Conflict, and Security. Dr. Robinson, welcome back.
Hello, good afternoon.
There was so much dispute about what actually happened in Syria. Again, this was the excuse used by first some parts of the Obama administration to launch an attack against Syria, an attack that basically Obama decided to punt on and not do. But then Donald Trump did do it. 59 cruise missiles crashed into Syria on the basis that it was retaliation and a strong message sent to Syria about the use of chemical weapons. Let's just talk about what this new news means.
Okay, well, since the event in Douma in April 2018, there have been a series of questions raised by myself and others, many others, in fact, regarding what actually happened in Douma. And the persisting question really is the question of whether or not this was a false flag event, which was carried out by opposition groups, Jihad al-Islam, in order to pull in a Western intervention, or whether it was an attack carried out by the Syrian government, as is alleged by Britain, France, and America. So that's the backdrop to this. That is the controversy which there is. What we have now with Riyam Dalati from the BBC and also the Harkin report are a series of claims now being made from people who have, certainly in the case of Riyam Dalati, has really pretty much reinforced the government line since this attack happened. Information coming from these people, which is essentially challenging parts of that narrative and obviously supporting the suspicions that many of us have had which relate to possibility of staging, manipulation and deception in the case of what happened in Douma. Now, obviously, Riyam Delati is apparently saying that an attack occurred, although what he means by that is unclear at this point in time. We need to hear more from him on that. But certainly, simply the kind of if one concedes that there has been staging going on of anything in relation to what happened in Douma, then it starts to beg more and more questions as to how far that staging and manipulation goes. Is it the case ultimately that this was a false flag event? And you know, this you mentioned the earlier the Ghouta attacks and Obama's red line and also the attacks after Khan Shukun, etc. I mean, these have been the sarin allegations of sarin attacks, but really throughout the conflict there's been this persistent narrative put forward that the Syrian government is using chemical weapons in violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention, etc., against civilians in the conflict. And from where I'm sitting and from the research that my working group is involved in, that's an incredibly open question. The OPC reports to date have a lack of clarity on exactly what has been going on. And I think at this point in time, especially with people like Riyam Delati saying what they're saying, we really need to consider very boldly and frankly the possibility of false flags having been occurred in Syria. And we need a proper investigation into this now, a proper international transparent investigation into what has been going on in Syria, especially when people like Riyam Delati are saying the things that they're saying.
Exactly. We're talking to Dr. Piers Robinson. Dr. Robinson, when you think about the use of any particular weapon, it's used because it has a military application. It has some efficacy. In the case of chemical weapons or biological weapons, certainly it has the impact of scaring, of instilling fear in the target. Perhaps it's the scariest of all weapons. It's also a banned weapon. It was used widely in World War I by all of the major powers. It was decided to get rid of chemical weapons and make them illegal. And partly the militaries of different countries decided, well, actually, they're not a very effective weapon. There are other weapons that have more effectiveness. But there's another part to the use of chemical weapons, which is why would a particular entity use them under the conditions of illegality, especially why would the Syrian government, at the moment that it appeared to be winning the war, and the only thing that could perhaps stop the Syrian government from winning the war was the outside intervention of major powers like the United States. And the United States proclaimed that there was a red line, that if there was any use of chemical weapons, it would give the United States the justification to intervene. Under those circumstances, I never understood why the Syrian government would use the one weapon at the moment that they were winning that would draw in the opposition forces, military forces that could possibly deprive them of victory. Anyway, what do you think about that?
That's a very reasonable question to ask, which is who benefits cui bono in these situations? And if you look at certainly the Khan Shukun event and then the airstrikes that Trump ordered following that, and if you look at what happened in Douma, these are points that the Khan Shukun, this was after Trump had said that the US would withdraw from Syria. And in the case of Douma, you have a situation where quite literally the Syrian government had almost, sort of removed all of Jaish al-Islam from the area, and a deal had been struck. And it's difficult to see there being any military interest in the part of the Syrian government to carry out, as you say, precisely the kind of strike which is likely to incur an international intervention or an intervention from America, France, and the UK. It doesn't make an awful lot of sense. I mean, I suppose some people might speculate that there was some kind of motivation there, but it really doesn't make an awful lot of sense. And that, in a sense, is why a lot of people and some military people did comment at the time. I think General Shaw, a British ex-military commander, said that he questioned sort of what the motivation could possibly be. And that's why people are asking questions about, well, was this a false flag? Was this staged by the group Jaish al-Islam in order to try and bring in an intervention in support of it?
We're talking to Dr. Piers Robinson about the new information about that raises the question of whether the chemical attack, if it occurred in Syria, was actually staged by the opposition. Piers, let's talk a little bit for our audience, which may not understand the ins and outs, the nuances of these kind of investigations. What's the role of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons? You've mentioned them, the OPCW. And what do they say? What have they said? Have they been able to gain access?
Well, okay, the OPCW has been tasked with investigating and has been investigating events in Syria. It's important to remember the OPCW is not the United Nations. It's also important to remember is there is controversy surrounding the OPCW. There's been criticism from Russia, and it's not as transparent as it should be, okay, in the way that it conducts its investigations. But putting all that to one side, in the case of Duma, thus far, the OPCW has stated that sarin was not found, okay, so that banned weapon was not used. It says that there were indications of chlorine, but they have not drawn a final report and published a final report to say what happened in the case of Duma. So at the moment, we don't have any information from the OPCW. When they do finally report, it's very important to look seriously at what they're saying, but it shouldn't necessarily be considered the final word. As we have found, as the working group on Syria propaganda and media, is that if you go back and look at earlier OPCW investigations and reports, there are some serious questions to be raised about the claims that have been made, about the kind of information sources which have been used during this conflict.
Piers, we have about 20 seconds. What does this suggest to you about the role of the so-called white helmets? We have 20 seconds.
Well, if it's the case that Riam Delati is referring to the white helmets having staged the hospital scenes in the case of Duma, it raises a lot of serious questions, and there should be an investigation into both the white helmets and also the actions of Western governments during this conflict to get to the bottom of what has been going on over the last 7 or 8 years.
That's all the time we have. We were joined from Sheffield, England by Dr. Piers Robinson. Dr. Robinson is the chairman of the Politics, Society, and Political Journalism Department at the University of Sheffield. He is the author of the book Routledge, Handbook of Media, Conflict, and Security. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. Elliot Abrams has been named by Donald Trump his special envoy to Venezuela. Elliot Abrams is a convicted criminal who played a key role in the Iran-Contra scandal and death squad operations in Latin America in the 1980s. He's also President Trump's special envoy for Venezuela, leading the effort to overthrow the government of President Nicolas Maduro and to install a puppet regime led by Juan Guaido. He testified yesterday before the House Foreign Affairs Committee, but faced a hostile crowd leery of his history of lying to Congress and his support of right-wing neoconservative foreign policies. We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Kay Pritzker. He is an activist and was arrested yesterday during the hearing. Kay, welcome to Loud and Clear.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for having me.
You're a free man.
Yes, I am.
So I saw the video clip. You and you're an organizer with the Answer Coalition, and along with Code Pink, which is well-known in the anti-war movement. While Elliot Abrams was testifying, you got up, you spoke out. What happened?
So we came to expose the truth about Elliot Abrams. We didn't want him to have the floor and have, you know, say only his side of the story without the people telling their side of the story. And at first, you know, when he arrived to the committee, to the room, he sat down and Medea Benjamin and I walked up to him very calmly, and we, you know, asked him, hey, can you answer for some of the war crimes you've committed or you've been complicit in? And he just ignored us. He didn't even look us in the eye. He had this, emotionless look on his face because I think he kind of thought, you know, he would be going home at the end of the day. He would go back to his mansion in the suburbs, and what, you know, activists, what American people had to say to him didn't really affect him. And when the committee began, or when the hearing began, you know, he was invited to testify. Congress was looking for his advice. They were soliciting his advice on Venezuela, which is funny because he lied to Congress.
He was convicted of lying to Congress.
Right. Yeah. He pled guilty to these two counts. And, you know, we weren't going to let that go unanswered. So Ariel Gold and I, Ariel Gold from Code Pink and I, we jumped up and we started yelling. We said, you know, don't listen to this war criminal, because he is a war criminal. And, you know, I started saying he wants to send weapons to right-wing factions in Venezuela like he did in Guatemala and El Salvador. And, you know, He didn't have a response. So we were pulled out of the room and we were arrested on the spot and taken to jail. We got let out maybe a few hours later.
We're speaking with Kay Pritzker about the hearing where Elliot Abrams testified before Congress. Kay was one of the people there who was there on a truth-telling mission and did so and was arrested for his good efforts. He's out now. He joined us in studio. I want to play a clip from Ilhan Omar. She's a congresswoman from Minnesota, part of the new freshman class of progressive congresspeople. She's really grilling Elliot Abrams about his history. At the very end, she sort of changes her tone, though, and she basically, it seems to me, accepts some of the presumptions of Elliot Abrams' propaganda and the Trump administration's propaganda. But it was a very dramatic moment in the U.S. Congress. Let's listen to this. It's about 3 minutes long, but I want to take the time to have our audience really hear her.
In 1991, you pleaded guilty to 2 counts of withholding information from Congress regarding your involvement in the Iran-Contra affair, for which you were later pardoned by President George H.W. Bush. I fail to understand why members of this committee or the American people should find any testimony that you give today to be truthful.
If I can respond to that.
It wasn't a question.
That was not a question.
I reserve the right to my time.
It is not right.
That was not a question.
Members of this committee can attack
on February 8th,
who is not permitted to reply.
That was not a question. Thank you for your participation. On February 8th, 1982, you testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee about U.S. policy in El Salvador. In that hearing, you dismissed as communist propaganda report about the massacre of El Masote, in which more than 800 civilians, including children as young as 2 years old, were brutally murdered by U.S.-trained troops. During that massacre, some of those troops bragged about raping a 12-year-old girl before they killed them. You later said that the U.S. policy in El Salvador was a fabulous achievement. Yes or no, do you still think so?
From the day that President Duarte was elected in a free election to this day, El Salvador has been a democracy. That's a fabulous achievement.
Yes or no, do you think that massacre was a fabulous achievement that happened under our watch?
That is a ridiculous question. And I
yes or no?
No.
I will take that as a yes.
I am not going to respond to that kind of personal attack, which is not a question.
Yes or no, would you support an armed faction within Venezuela that engages in war crimes, crimes against humanity or genocide, if you believe they were serving U.S. interest, as you did in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Nicaragua?
I am not going to respond to that question. I'm sorry. I don't think this entire line of questioning is meant to be real questions, and so I will not reply.
Whether you, under your watch, a genocide will take place, and you will look the other way because American interests were being upheld is a fair question, because the American people want to know that anytime we engage a country, that we think about what our actions could be and how we believe our values are being furthered. That is my question. Will you make sure that human rights are not violated and that we uphold international and human rights?
I suppose there is a question in there, and the answer is that the entire thrust of American policy in Venezuela is to support the Venezuelan people's effort to restore democracy to their country. That's our policy.
I don't think anybody disputes that. The question I had for you is that does the interest of the United States include protecting human rights and include protecting people against genocide?
That is always the position of the United States.
Thank you.
All right. Kay Pritzker is our guest. Ilhan Omar was the congresswoman from Minnesota, Somali-American politician. She was grilling Elliot Abrams, Donald Trump's new envoy to Venezuela. That was a really remarkable back and forth, I think.
Yeah.
And I want to sort of break it down and unpack it. I mean, What she was basically doing was using the form of a question to document Elliot Abrams' criminal activities in Latin America. And then at the end, though, she says, will the United States look the other way should similar war crimes be committed now in Venezuela? And he basically says, no, we're only there to help the Venezuelans gain democracy. And she says at the very end, in spite of that dramatic opposition, I don't dispute that. In a way, Elliot Abrams gets the last word there.
Yeah. I think that kind of throws the whole, you know, the thrust of her argument out the window if she says, you know, I don't dispute that this is a humanitarian cause. Like, the whole point of our action and her action is to show that he's not a humanitarian, that the goals of these interventions are not humanitarian. They are to promote U.S. interests in these countries. And it's kind of a shame. I was arrested 5 feet from a war criminal. All of the people in the room knew his war record. You could look this stuff up. She, you know, Ilhan Omar had exposed it on the congressional floor. And, you know, we were the ones arrested when he was obviously more worthy of going to prison that day than any of us. So, you know, it is kind of a surreal moment where, you know, this man's war crimes are just aired out in the open. And then at the end, it just comes back to a capitulation. You're a humanitarian.
Yeah, well, she doesn't quite say he's a humanitarian, but she says when he argues that the U.S. goal is really just to promote democracy and to help the Venezuelan people, she says, I don't dispute
that. Yeah.
So that's the thing is, let's just talk about from your point of view. You were there. You made a protest. You got arrested. What do you think the real role of the U.S. in Venezuela is? You said the U.S. interest, but what do you mean by U.S. interest in Venezuela?
I think the best way to answer this question is to just look at what Elliot Abrams has done in the past. He, you know, he helped overthrow, or he was attempting to overthrow, the socialist government in Nicaragua, the Sandinista government. He tried to maintain these right-wing governments in El Salvador and Guatemala. And he also encouraged the failed 2002 coup in Venezuela. And it seems like the goal is always to overthrow governments that protect the national interests of their own people, that want to nationalize the country's resources or use the country's resources and wealth and labor to promote wealth for their own people. And it seems like what Elliot Abrams wants is for private American oil companies to come in, take Venezuela's oil, mining companies to take their gold, et cetera, et cetera.
And again, when we think about this issue, Kay, you're there representing a big part of the American people that don't want the United States to go to war again.
Mm-hmm.
They don't believe that the United States should be busy overthrowing sovereign governments like they're trying to do in Venezuela.
Mm-hmm.
So when Elliot Abrams or any of the people in Congress talk about U.S. interests, it's not clear to me that they are talking about the interests of the American people. And we can see that there is a lot of mobilization going on from American people who are saying to the government, you say you're speaking in our name, in the name of the American people, in our interests, but you're doing so in a way that's, one, not legal, and two, not moral, and three, without our consent.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of mobilization going forward.
Yeah, there is. You know, I think especially in these times under the Trump era, you know, he's had so many of these assaults on working Americans. He's passed these tax cuts, which only help the rich. He's, deregulated the economy. And average Americans, working class Americans, are feeling that. And they're also seeing Trump and the Pentagon spending all this money trying to overthrow governments overseas, saying that, you know, our freedoms are over there, we need to get our freedoms back and all this stuff. And I think, you know, there's this cognitive dissonance, or people are starting to realize, I don't feel free here. I don't feel served by my own government here, but they're spending all this money over there, and I can see right in front of my own eyes, I can see in my own hands that I am deprived, that the government should be spending our tax money on us.
Yeah, and Kay, there's a demonstration coming up. I know you're working on it on March 16th in Washington. Last 10 seconds.
Yeah, there's a big march going on in Washington, D.C., March 16th, to just show that the American people do not stand with this coup in Venezuela. Yeah, hands off Venezuela.
All right, that's the voice of Kay Pritzker. We were joined by Kay here in the Washington, D.C. studio. He, along with people from Code Pink, carried out a truth-telling mission during the U.S. congressional hearing yesterday where Elliot Abrams testified. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Our friend and contributor Ted Rall recently had a major court decision go against him in California. This was a case that had very important implications for Americans' constitutional rights to freedom of speech. In the end, the court decided essentially that Ted's right to criticize the Los Angeles Police Department was less important than the Los Angeles Times' right to block Ted's right to freedom of speech. It's a case with very important constitutional implications, and Ted is appealing that ruling to the California Supreme Court. He's here to update us on developments. Ted joins us from New York. He's an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist, and you can check out his work at www.rawl.com. Welcome back, Ted.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Ted, what's new? The last time we spoke with you, you said that you intended to appeal this to the California Supreme Court. Have you gone ahead and done that?
That's imminent. It's going to be within the next, I think the brief is due in about 2 or 3 weeks. And we've also been gathering amicus briefs from First Amendment organizations that finally woke up to what's going on. And so now we suddenly have support from quite an august list of First Amendment groups that are stepping up to provide support, which is remarkable because they're usually on the side of press freedom and on the side of newspapers in legal disputes. And in this case, you have these groups are siding with me against the Los Angeles Times.
We have to go over very quickly and succinctly what the case is. You were fired, and you were fired because of pressure from police, and you litigated on behalf of your right to have employment there and not to be basically censored vis-a-vis police pressure. And you were hit with an anti-slap motion, which is usually designed to protect the little guy, thus requiring you to pay all of the legal costs of the Los Angeles Times. So it's hundreds of thousands of dollars you have to pay them because you sued based on the discrimination that you suffered as their employee or as their contractor.
That's right. Most Americans live in states with anti-slap laws that they may never have even heard of. But they're kind of strange. They're strange animals because in this case, I'm the victim of what the LA Times did by proxy for the LAPD. And so I'm the victim. So I'm the plaintiff. But then the defendant files an anti-slap motion. And sort of in a way, I become the defendant because I have to prove without the benefit of being able to subpoena documents or subpoena witnesses, I have to prove that I have a chance of prevailing at trial to a judge. I don't even have a right to a jury trial. I have to prove it to a judge first before he or she will allow me to see a jury.
SLAPP is a strategic lawsuit against public participation. SLAPP is a lawsuit that is intended to censor, intimidate, and silence critics by burdening them with the cost of a legal defense until they abandon their criticism or opposition. Anyway, just talk real quickly how this is sort of the goal or the function of anti-slap motions or lawsuits is being turned on its head.
Yeah, well, the problem is under U.S. law, you can't have different classes of plaintiffs and defendants, right? You can't say this right or that right only goes to this class of defendant, basically poor defendant, rich defendant, whatever. There's only defendants, there's only plaintiffs. So the anti-slap law basically states that I have to prove that I have a good chance of winning my case, and if I don't prove that to a judge, then I have to pay the legal fees of the Times. So that's what happened now in two rulings. I have at this point $330,000 in legal bills that I owe the Times, and it's probably going to be a lot more than that by the time it's all over, unless the California Supreme Court agrees to hear the case and understands that there's some major problems with the anti-slap statute. And that they have been reining in the statute in various important court decisions in California, which is the first state to have an anti-slap law. So there is some hope there. And there's also the fact that, quite simply, the judges did not, in my case, really disobeyed the anti-slap law anyway. They weren't supposed to weigh the evidence. They were supposed to simply weigh the case and see if there was the bare minimum of a case there. And they didn't do that.
You know, I'm wondering, too, the logistics of this whole thing. If you go to the Supreme Court, if the Supreme Court agrees to hear the case and you go there and you argue your case and you lose, are you still on the hook for all of the LA Times legal bills?
You mean the ones going up to the Supreme Court?
The ones going up to the Supreme Court, because it seems to me that's strongly anti-democratic. I mean, it would seriously discourage people who have been wronged from using the system to find justice.
And Ted, some people are saying, it's a whisper, that the LA Times has more money than you do, so they have the ability to go after you like this. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, at the time I sued, they were owned by Tribune Publishing, which was worth about $500 million in market capitalization. And now they're owned by a billionaire who's worth about $7 billion, named Patrick Soon-Shiong, who's a biotechnology entrepreneur. So yeah, they have a little more money than I do. And yes, it's pay to play. The more I keep the case going, the longer, the higher the LA, my exposure to having to pay the LA Times legal bills. It is not impossible that I would lose at the Supreme Court level and end up owing the LA Times $1 million. It is not impossible.
My God.
Now, the thing is, I can tell you that it's discouraging because when I was looking for lawyers to represent me, quite a few of them, many of them said, listen, you're going to win if you ever get before a jury because what happened to you is objectively disgusting and you proved you were right. The problem is getting past the anti-SLAPP law is going to be so hard. And a lot of lawyers refused to take the case based on that. And other lawyers just simply said, you should not sue them. You can't beat the LA Times in an LA court. It's not possible. And with the anti-SLAPP statute, you could be bankrupted. So it is absolutely, the anti-SLAPP law prevents a very chilling effect against anyone who really was wronged by a media company.
Ted Rall, let's go back. You know, when we talked to you about this about a week ago, you thought that the Fraternal Order of Police, or whatever the police union is in LA, exerted influence and pressure on the LA Times, and thus you were fired as a consequence. I think I've heard that you amended your view on that, but let's talk about how this evolved. And also, let's just real quickly go back to what the core originating issue was.
Yeah, well, the core originating issue was jaywalking. In 2015, the LAPD conducted a crackdown on jaywalking in LA, primarily targeted in downtown LA, so therefore disproportionately targeting people of color and poor working class people. So I did, and I was assigned to do this cartoon and an accompanying blog piece by my editor at the time. And I did the cartoon, I did a blog post that went with it. The blog post included the detail, it wasn't really about this, but it included the detail that, hey, I know a little bit about this. I got personally arrested and mistreated by an LAPD officer who falsely arrested me for jaywalking and handcuffed me and treated me so badly that there was an angry crowd of people yelling at him back in 2001. And so the LAPD chief, now we now know it was not the Police Protective, which is the union who owns the LA Times at the time, but it was actually the chief of police, Charlie Beck, who has since resigned, who I should say, I guess officially he retired. Charlie Beck walked my file, the internal affairs complaint file that I filed back in 01, over to the LA Times publisher, Austin Buettner, who was also fired since these events, who is now the superintendent of public schools in LA and made some headlines in the recent teacher strike, and gave him the files and said, hey, look, these files prove that Ted Rall lied when he said that he was handcuffed and that there was an angry crowd of people yelling at the cop. Included in there is a secret audio tape taken by the officer back in 01 that nobody knew that cops were recording arrests. And they said, look, listen to this. You can see that actually the cop was nice to Ted. Actually, you can't hear anything really on the audio at all. It's just noise. And they said, well, you know, the LA Times came to me and said, well, this proves that you lied. And I said, it doesn't prove anything. It's just noise. And they fired me and then published a piece in the paper calling me a liar. And so I had the audio enhanced, cleaned up to remove the traffic noise and wind. And you could actually hear people screaming at the police officer in very vulgar terms that I could not repeat here on the radio, saying, among other things, take off his handcuffs. So this completely, 1,000% vindicates my story, which was true. And, you know, it wasn't exactly the most outlandish story. Cops in LA handcuff people for jaywalking all the time. And they tend to be very rough. So it's not a very unusual thing to have happen anyway. But anyway, the LA Times, instead of taking me back and issuing a retraction, which is what they ought to have done, issued a second piece 3 weeks later saying that they had looked into it again and reconfirmed that I had lied.
This is crazy.
It's amazing. I mean, this is the chief of police personally walking Ted Rall's file into the publisher of the LA Times because Ted said these jaywalking arrests, including the arrest of him, are bad things. That's how sensitive the police are. I mean, that's our democracy.
Talk about snowflakes, huh? I mean, that's really the definition of
it. Good point. Good point. Those poor LAPD, they're always the victim of people like you, Ted Rall, going around and telling the truth about what they're actually doing to others and to yourself. Anyway, we know Ted Rall. We love his cartoons. It's important. But this also has huge implications for people's rights. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We're going to come back and discuss it though.
We absolutely will have Ted back to talk about this again. We were joined from New York by Ted Rall. Ted's an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. Be sure to check out his work at www.rall.com. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe confirmed yesterday that FBI officials were so alarmed by President Trump's decision to fire former FBI Director James Comey that they held talks on recruiting a cabinet member to push Trump out of office using the Constitution's 25th Amendment. Meanwhile, a federal judge yesterday ruled that former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort breached the terms of his plea deal by lying to investigators after taking the deal. The ruling virtually ensures that, absent a presidential pardon, Manafort will die in prison. We're joined from Toronto by Dan Kovalik, a human rights attorney and labor attorney who is the author of the new book, The Plot to Control the World, How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcome of Elections Around the World. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you, John.
Dan, this interview that Andrew McCabe gave to 60 Minutes is explosive, to say the least. He talks about this this plan, really, to push Donald Trump out of office using Rod Rosenstein. And Brian and I were talking off the air a minute ago. This looks very much like the beginnings of a coup attempt. What do you think?
Yeah, well, you took the words right out of my mouth. I mean, that's exactly what it was. And, you know, we've been talking about this for a while, that in many ways, the Russiagate scandal, so to speak, has always appeared to look like a coup attempt by the intelligence agencies against Trump. And now we know that there was a plan to get him out of office. So it is fascinating, to say the least.
Dan Kovalik is our guest. I'm looking at the Hill newspaper. McCabe says DOJ, this Department of Justice, talked 25th Amendment. Rosenstein offered to wear wire around Trump was serious, colon, says the report. I'm going to read a couple of sentences to Dan Kovalik and also for our audience and then pursue this discussion. Former acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe in a new interview reveals fresh details of the investigation into President Trump, telling CBS that there were conversations about the possibility of removing Trump under the 25th Amendment and confirming that Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein had offered to wear a wire around the president. McCabe spoke to 60 Minutes. Now, he's promoting his new book. CBS News' Scott Pelley appeared on CBS This Morning Thursday to discuss his interview with Andrew McCabe, saying that McCabe told him about the efforts to figure out, quote, what to do, close quote, with Trump during the 8 days between the firing of then FBI Director James Comey and the appointment of special counsel Robert Mueller. Quote, there were meetings at the Justice Department at which it was discussed whether the vice president and a majority of the cabinet could be brought together to remove the president of the United States under the 25th Amendment, close quote. Pelley, that's the guy who interviewed McCabe, said Thursday, quote, and the highest levels of American law enforcement were trying to figure out what to do with the president, close quote. Okay, we're opposed to Donald Trump. We're opposed to his policies. This makes clear that the FBI and senior intelligence agents were in the process of, quote, figuring out how to take down the president of the United States. That is, by all definitions, a coup d'etat or an attempted coup d'etat. Go ahead, Dan.
It's incredible. And we always have to preface our comments on this saying, you know, we don't support Trump and, you know, we think he's a terrible president. But the fact is he was elected. And here you have the FBI very shortly, it wasn't very long after Trump's inauguration, trying to find a way to get him out of office. I mean, people need to be concerned about this, that you have an intelligence agency that thinks it can decide who's the president of the United States. It's very troubling.
Andrew McCabe's family, including his wife, who was running for a Democratic Party official
position, state Senate seat in Virginia,
and she had gotten lots of money, donations, I think $500,000 in 2016 from Terry McAuliffe, former governor of Virginia and a top friend and assistant of Hillary Clinton. These were the same people who were involved in the Steele dossier, assembling opposition research, paying for opposition research by a foreign agent. That would be Christopher Steele. He was a British intelligence agent, and he was the one working with Russians to get dirt on Donald Trump, whether it's true or not, vetted or it wasn't vetted. Nonetheless, these are exactly the things that they accused Donald Trump of doing.
Yeah, well, again, what really is troubling here is that, you know, the FBI should be an agent of our elected officials. They should be governed by our elected officials and held accountable to the American people in that way. Here you have the FBI deciding, again, to try to derail people's campaigns, and then once they're elected, to try to unseat them. I mean, again, this should be of concern to everyone who cares about our Constitution, who cares about democracy, because the truth is, if they would do it to a Donald Trump, they would certainly do it to someone, you know, that those of us on the left would like more. You know, it shows an agency really out of control and, again, not accountable to the American people.
You know, interestingly enough, Rosenstein apparently wants none of this. He issued a statement earlier this morning in which he says that, or actually the Justice Department spokesman said, Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein again rejects Mr. McCabe's recitation of events as inaccurate and factually incorrect. So he's still in his position. So yeah, of course he's going to have to say something like that.
But think about it this way. Let's say McCabe is lying.
Right.
Because he's promoting a book. Okay, let's just assume that. That means McCabe, who the Democratic Party elites was saying he's the victim of Trump and he's the guardian of our democracy. If he's lying, what he's basically telling us is, we tried to make a coup, but in fact, he didn't try to make a coup,
right,
but he should be saluted because he did try to make a coup.
Right.
Now, how does that add up as a winning argument and then still pretend that you're for democratic ideals?
Yeah, it doesn't work that way. As you say, it's a contradiction in terms to support a coup, again, by apparatchiks of the FBI against an elected president and then claim you're Democratic. I mean, there's nothing Democratic about it. And people who were involved in such a thing probably could be tried for treason.
Dan Kovalik, also, Trump was angry at the FBI because he felt they were out to get him. And he also said there was no collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. Now, that's turning out, actually, most sources are now saying there's not going to be anything from the Mueller probe proving that. And Trump was arguing that he was the victim of a witch hunt, that Russiagate was, in fact, a witch hunt. And that's why he was antagonizing or speaking badly about the FBI and their handling of all of this. Remember what Chuck Schumer said? He said, quote, let me tell you, you take on the intelligence community, they have six ways from Sunday at getting back at you. Now, again, doesn't the FBI and the CIA and these intelligence agencies, at least on paper, at least what the people are told, aren't they supposed to be working for the people and being like a sub-agency within the executive branch of the government and not this agency that has the ability to retaliate, bring you down, destroy you, six ways to Sunday to make your life hard? And here's Schumer saying, yeah, don't mess with the FBI. And people like Chuck Schumer?
What's so disappointing to me, and I'd like to hear Dan's thoughts on this too, is that it's not new that the FBI or the CIA would want to go after someone they don't like. They've been doing this.
Martin Luther King.
J. Edgar Hoover was doing it from the early 1930s. Martin Luther King, the CIA assassination program, all different kinds of things over the years. So my question, it's a rhetorical one, but I'd like to hear Dan's thoughts. Where is the new or the next Pat Moynihan? Where is Otis Pike? Where's Frank Church? Why don't we have any of these leaders on Capitol Hill who are willing to stand up in either party, who are willing to stand up to the likes of the FBI and the CIA?
Yeah, well, isn't that a great question? I think the answer is that you have a different culture now, both in Congress and, frankly, largely amongst the American people, who seem okay with the intelligence services doing these sorts of things and taking on powers, again, that only our elected officials should have. People are now romanticizing people like James Comey. And it's quite, to me, it's very scary, you know, because it does mean you probably will not see another Frank Church type committee, and that this thing is going to go on. And again, what it's going to do is they're going to take down people who we believe in and who are challenging the state. That's how these things go.
Yeah, Dan is completely right. I want people to remember J. Edgar Hoover, from the moment the FBI was formed, they were witch hunting socialists, the Palmer raids, deporting 10,000 people, arresting thousands, then the 1930s, then COINTELPRO in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, targeting the civil rights movement. Why should any progressive person, again, we're all opposed to Donald Trump's policy, but why should a progressive people then look to the same organization, the FBI, which is now clearly was trying to undo the outcome of the 2016 election, and say, because we don't like Trump and the FBI was using illegal coup-like methods to overthrow Donald Trump, that somehow the FBI now has this exalted stature as the guardians of our democracy? That's the wrong way to look at this.
We have to keep up the fight. We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Toronto by Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer who's the author of the book, The Plot to Control the World, How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcome of Elections Around the World. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
It's time again for our regular weekly segment, Veterans for Peace, where we'll discuss contemporary issues of war and peace that affect veterans, their families, and the country as a whole. We're joined every week from California by Jerry Condon. He's a Vietnam-era veteran and war resister who has been a peace and solidarity activist for almost 50 years, currently as the national president of Veterans for Peace. And we're happy to be joined by a special guest this week. That's Skip Delano from the Save Our VA Healthcare Working Group of Veterans for Peace. He joins us from New York. Welcome to both of you.
Happy to be here. Very glad to be here.
Jerry, the War Powers Act has been in the news again over the past week or so, especially this week, the last couple of days, because of a vote in Congress. The War Powers Act is something that I think is very important in contemporary government policy, but it's generally been ignored, at least since the Reagan presidency. In Congress this week, it has been debated specifically as it relates to U.S. support for Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates in their war in Yemen. Talk to us about the War Powers Act and its chances for actually being passed and signed again in Congress.
Right. Well, I'm not sure exactly about the chances of it being passed in Congress, but I know it's certainly time for the Congress to reassert its constitutional authority over the war-making power. And I was encouraged also to hear yesterday that the Democratic chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the House said that if there's going to be any military intervention against Venezuela, it would have to come from the House of Representatives. It would have to come from the Congress. So there are people in the Congress now that are asserting those powers, and it's certainly, aside from the War Powers Act itself, of course, the resolution that what was passed in the House yesterday and also in December in the Senate was a bill that would cut off all U.S. funding for U.S. support for the Saudi-led genocide in Yemen. And that's very, very significant that both houses of the Congress have been moved to act. They've been pressed by many people to do so. Trump is threatening to veto that, but it really does express the will of the people. I think it's important. You know, tens of thousands of children are literally dying of starvation in Yemen. So I think it's really important that the U.S. peace movement and all peace-loving people press the government to finally end that horrible slaughter.
John, what Jerry is saying is important because, let's face it, Congress has few powers, the power of the purse, the budget, and the power to declare war. And since 1941, it's never exercised that power. But we have war after war after war. Korea, Vietnam, you name it, Iraq, Afghanistan, Iraq, again, like war after war. And the Congress gives up its constitutionally mandated authority so the imperial presidency can act as an imperial power, sending people for endless war. And then at the same time, While the U.S. government and Trump administration right now saying we love our veterans, we put them on a pedestal, we owe them a great debt, and yet they are sick, they come back with injuries, they have high suicide rates, and now these same forces that say profess their love of people who served in the military are now trying to actually privatize healthcare services at the VA and make a lot of money off of the health care for veterans.
You know, I read something just the other day saying that by a factor of something like 20, there are that many more veterans who have committed suicide than who were killed in battle in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And the truth of the matter is that they are just not getting adequate health care and mental health care at VA facilities around the country.
And we have Skip Delano on the line, and we're extremely happy we do. Skip has a new article on the Veterans for Peace website called New Rules Lead to Privatization of the VA. Skip Delano, what's going on?
Well, I mean, a lot of people don't know a whole lot about veterans, and they don't know about the veterans' health care system. And one of our goals is to help educate people about it, because people don't know who serves or who gets care at the VA, who doesn't get care at the VA, and that the VA is actually a model for VA healthcare in America. And that there's a whole campaign from the right, Republicans are leading it, have mounted for the last 4 years, to dismantle the VA and outsource veterans' healthcare to the private sector. And going back to, you mentioned mental health and suicides. If vets go to the VA, they're much, much better taken care of. And if they don't, many of those who commit suicide never seek help from the VA. And that's something both the military itself as well as the VA are trying to do what they can, but end up in many suicides continue to happen. So it is a huge problem in America.
And what would privatization do to that? Let's say that there's a veteran who needs and wants mental health care. He goes to the VA, he gets that mental health care. What happens then if that is privatized?
Well, there are actually groups being set up specifically to try to exploit that and make money while providing veterans health care in the private sector. The VA has an excellent record around serving veterans with mental health issues, has a long history. One thing to remember about the VA, again, people don't understand that it's an institution set up to serve veterans, knows military culture, it knows the experience of soldiers who served in war, and that helps inform them of how to provide the best health care possible. Nothing is perfect, and the VA is not perfect by any means, and there's no reason that vets shouldn't be allowed to go to private health care if that's necessary. But again, the VA is the institution that has the experience and ability to really serve veterans better than anywhere else. I'd say the other thing to understand about the whole effort to dismantle the VA, it's sort of a larger agenda of Republicans and opponents of anything that the taxpayer-supported public services like schools, housing, and any Obamacare, Medicare, all these opponents of the VA also oppose these services provided by the government. So their agenda is much larger than us. The attack on the VA has been led in particular by the Koch brothers, the far-right billionaires who set up a group called Concerned Veterans of America specifically to lead this assault on the VA. And they've been very, very effective. They were given $40 million to kind of undermine the VA, and they, like I said, have done it very, very effectively. All they try to do is talk about how the VA is dysfunctional. And remember, it's a huge institution with 150 hospitals across the country, 1,000 clinics, and serving 250,000 people every day. So you know there are going to be problems with it. But overall, you know, private studies have shown, independent studies, that it's the best health care system possible serving veterans.
That's the voice of Skip Delano. Jerry Condon, president of Veterans for Peace. Go ahead.
I just wanted to underline the fact that a lot of our members in Veterans for Peace do use the VA health services, and generally speaking, have, believe it or not, high praise for it, because all you hear is the stories about the inadequacies. So, you know, there are some problems, but they're being greatly exaggerated in an effort to totally basically shut down the VA and replace it with privatization. These folks don't really want greater access for health care for veterans. They want greater access for billionaires to make profits off of this health care. So it's pretty atrocious.
Skip Delano, we have 2 minutes left. Real quick, what are you telling people to do? What is Veterans for Peace trying to do? I mean, what veterans have basically is Medicare for all veterans, right? I mean, that's the system, or it's even better than Medicare. That doesn't mean that there aren't major problems with the service. Nonetheless, privatization, it seems to me, is going in the absolutely wrong direction, at least for healthcare for veterans. What should people do? What can they do?
Well, I mean, people need to call their congressman. And one really great thing is we have a Democratic Congress, and we have a House Veterans Affairs Committee headed up by Democrats, and they are out to try to stop privatization so that people can, you know, give them support by writing Congress and urging them to make sure that privatization doesn't happen. The other thing to say is that, like you were just saying, is that our country has been in a healthcare crisis for many, many years, continues to be. And one thing that the VA healthcare provides is a model, like you say, for America. In other words, it's an integrated healthcare system. I go to see a doctor, and all my doctors communicate in a data system that puts everything together so I get the best care possible when I go. And that's the kind of system we all need in America. It's sort of the best example in our country of socialized medicine. So that's, again, another reason they're trying to destroy it, because they don't want that as a model for the rest of America.
Well, we were happy to be joined from California by Jerry Condon. He's a Vietnam-era veteran and war resister who has been a peace and solidarity activist for almost 50 years, currently as the national president of Veterans for Peace. And we were also joined today from New York City by Skip Delano. He's from the Save Our VA Healthcare Working Group. That is also part of Veterans for Peace. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.